ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back. Thank you for tuning in. Henrik here, Red Ice TV. Great to have you all with us. Hope you have having a wonderful day wherever you are. Today we have a great show lined up for you with none other than Mark Collett, who joins us today from the UK. Great to have you back. Mark, how's it going?
It's going very well, thank you. And it's always a pleasure to be back. It's always a pleasure to be back. And it was also a pleasure hosting you on our 100th and final show of this week on the alt-right, just the other week.
So tell us about that. That was the final show, and now you're doing, was it Patriotic Weekly Review? Was that another show you started up? Tell us about this.
Yeah, it's still exactly the same time, exactly the same format, exactly the same panel, bringing exactly the same content. But we thought it needed a rebrand. We thought it needed something that was far more friendly to the public, or normie friendly, because the alt-right label has really run its course. I think it was good around Trump time, but I think post-Charlottesville, it's been dragged through the mud a little. And the
little bit. A tiny bit.
A tiny bit. And I think it's really kind of the whole idea of the alt-right has kind of declined in not only in popularity, but also in public perception. And I think something like Patriotic Weekly Review, that will appeal to our people, but it will also appeal to a wider number of normal people. It'll be more shareable on social networks, and I think it'll be more welcoming to people who are interested in what we have to say but are put off by certain labels. So we're going ahead with that. And we had our first show on Wednesday, and we had Adam Green on it.
Oh, great.
It was a really, really good show with really high viewer numbers. So got off to a good start, and we're going to be moving forward with that.
Excellent. Yeah, I saw that on your YouTube. I just went there and I was like, hey, Patriotic Weekly. I was like, is this starting another stream or is this an addition? So I actually didn't know that you were rebranding it that way. But I do think that that's, smart to a certain extent. I agree. It's been, unfortunately, I guess. I mean, again, it doesn't matter the nomenclature, right? What the beliefs are the same. It doesn't matter what it is. But that's a good move, I think. So good luck with the new show and congratulations again on the 100th. It was great, being on for just 10 minutes. You guessed it, a long stream. That's always fun to do those kinds of marathons as well. So it's challenging. But Mark, why don't we dive into some of the first topics here? For today, I actually wanted to begin on the royal baby and talk about your view in terms of where the British monarchy is ending up when it turns out that one of the heirs, Harry, in this case, marries a commoner, an American in this case, and they're having a baby. Of course, she's mixed race, so this is celebrated across the globe as something wonderful. And finally, it's like they're following that pattern of like these stereotypical Hollywood movies where it's always about kind of breaking down tradition and breaking through the barriers. And it seems like either that programming went to Harry's head or this is directions from above. I'm not sure. But what's your take on this, on the new royal baby?
Well, I can tell you this for one thing. If I was a prince, if I was one of the most powerful and richest men on the planet, I certainly wouldn't be marrying some B or C list washed up actress, divorcee, several years my senior. I can tell you that now. And she also is a little bit of a plain Jane. She's not unattractive, but, you know, this guy is a prince. He could have had any woman he wanted the world over. And he ended up like this. And I think it's very, very telling of the state of the royal family that a prince would end up in this situation. And it also shows a real lack of judgment on his behalf as well, especially when you look into her past. I mean, this guy, not only could he have any woman, but if you were picking a woman and you were in his position, you certainly wouldn't pick one who is known for performing roles where she simulates oral sex in cars. You know, that was one of her roles. She was on an American show. I think it was the revival of Beverly Hills 90210, where in the opening episode, she was filmed simulating oral sex in a car outside of college. I mean, that's just embarrassing. And that would be embarrassing for any normal guy. But for a prince of England, that's quite scandalous, really. And I think they have broken with tradition. They've embarrassed themselves. They've tried to politicize this. And the left have obviously loved it. But I find the left, again, very hypocritical, because the left have always been absolutely anti-royalist. They've hated the royal family and have wanted it abolishing for years. And now they're holding up the royal family as champions of diversity. So again, you see the leftist hypocrisy here. I've never been a huge fan of the royal family. And the reason being is because they do nothing for the British people.
That's right. Yeah, there's like nothing there. It's just a hollowed out. And I mean, this is true in most European countries, of course. It's just a symbolic, like a, I don't know, like a face really of the nation. And in some cases, I don't know how it is in the UK. It's the same there. They're not like a kind of really allowed to engage in political questions. Obviously, they do, but they're supposedly they're not.
Well, that's something that really sickens me, actually, because every time, and this is what a lot of royalists say, and a lot of royalists claim to be patriots, they claim to be nationalists, and they constantly say every time the royal family fail to stick up for decent traditionalist people or fail to stick up for the nation, the royalists will cry, oh, but they're not allowed to be political, their hands are tied, they can't say anything. Of course they can. Every time they speak about politics, they speak about culture, but always promoting something that is to do with diversity or a leftist world outlook. And as far as I'm concerned, a royal family is only useful and good for the nation if the royal family supports that nation and supports the prosperity of the people, which these people don't. These people are, to me, they have become nothing more than celebrities who endorse the multiracial system. And really, they are quite anti-British, and they're certainly anti-white. If you, anyone who's been keeping up with the Queen's speech, she every year she praises Britain's multicultural society and says that's what makes Britain so wonderful. I don't believe these people have a right to rule. I don't believe the royal family have a right to call themselves royals if they don't defend their own people. And the argument that they can't do it. What are you telling me? Some of the richest and most powerful people in the country have their hands tied and can't speak their mind. Of course they can. They can say whatever they want, but they want to support the status quo because they think that will enrich them, which to me makes them cowards. And it makes them people that I will not support.
Yeah, definitely. Remember this article, Meghan Markle backs campaign to tackle male, pale and stale universities, right? So you get that kind of narrative even from them now that there's somehow it's something wrong, that Britain is white and stuff. And of course, one thing that I found very strange, I actually want to listen just a little bit of a snippet in that clip that I was showing. The reporter is asking who he takes after, right? The boy.
Sweetest temperament. He's really calm and... he's just been the dream, so it's been a special couple days.
Who does he take after? Does he look like anyone?
Does it look like anyone? Listen to this answer.
Everyone says the baby's changed so much over 2 weeks. We're basically sort of monitoring how the changing process happens over this next month, really. But his looks are changing every single day. Yeah. So who knows?
We're monitoring how he's changed. They say they change every 2 weeks, so we're monitoring the situation and seeing if maybe in a month we'll see if it looks like anybody. Isn't that kind of a weird, stale answer, Mark?
I would say, from the position of a man, if I was to have a son, I would want my son to look like me,
yes,
to embody my features, to be truly something that reflected me. And I've met many women during my life, and most women want children and they want a daughter. Most men want a son and most women want a daughter. And women who want a daughter always say they want their daughter to look like them. And I find it awfully, awfully unnatural when I see people who have children and they know that what they are doing will produce a child that looks nothing like them. How would you even identify with a child if it shared nothing in common with you? And that baby may not share much in common with him. And I think that's a way that the multiracialists, the multiculturalists, want to dilute us. They want to dilute who we are. And they are pushing a very, very unnatural agenda, because it's absolutely natural and normal for people to want their children to look like them.
Yeah, I don't know. I find it so strange. It's like, I would have said, well, yeah, he kind of looks like me when I did in one of my photos or so. Yeah, he has your eyes or something, you know, but it's like, we're monitoring the situation. And I know that some of these royals can be kind of stale, you know, it's like, it can get kind of weird and odd. And we have the same thing in Sweden too. Reporters ask the king a question and he's all odd and stuff. And like, well, they don't let us even ride in elevators. And, you know, it's like weird things come out like that. But I don't know.
Well, there is one thing I've got to pick up on there. I didn't notice this before, but he said something very odd. The baby's changed. I believe he said the baby has changed so much over 2 weeks. Well, was their baby born?
No, I thought that first too. I realized, and then he says, they say that babies change so much in the first 2 weeks. I know. I thought that first too. Oh, they're saying it's been around for 2 weeks already, you know, kind of thing.
Well, the other interesting thing about this is the baby has come out. From first glance, it actually looks pretty much white. And I can imagine that's really, really annoyed a lot of leftists. I bet leftists had their fingers crossed, hoping that it would come out looking much, much darker. Because for their propaganda, they would absolutely love to have a dark-skinned British royal.
Yeah, exactly. I think that that's what they're kind of hoping for. I know that there were some funny conspiracies flying around, too, that it's really it's really a doll and, you know, it's not real and stuff. And, you know, they put that little beanie on and stuff so you can't kind of see as well. You know, a lot of people are looking at that. Because you're right. I mean, we saw the tweets in hindsight. A lot of people that were wishing that, you know, finally we can get a person who looks like an African into the Windsor family kind of thing, right? And what is he, 20, she's what, 50% African, so he would be, what, 25% or something like that. So we'll see how the genetic expression looks, but I don't know. There's been a lot of oddities around this, I feel, a bit contrived and kind of not natural in many ways. What do you think?
Well, I think the real conspiracy here is Harry was once famous for wearing that Nazi armband and dressing up as a stormtrooper, as a member of the SA, and he has called his son Archie Harrison. So I think the real conspiracy here is he once dressed as a Nazi, and now his child has got the initials AH. I think the press needs to pick up on that.
Yeah, I was hoping the photo was in this article. But yeah, Prince Harry apologizes for Nazi costume. I remember this back in 2005. And it's funny, too, because then people in hindsight have said, well, is this just something to, like, kind of make up for all the things, right? And even the fact that the British royal family has been accused of kind of, like, you know, upholding colonialism or those kinds of attitude, right? So that there is a political pressure on the family to try to intentionally diversifying itself, right, to a certain extent, to try to look better in the eyes of the people. And that's why some people have said, well, that's why this happened with Harry, because he's still not someone who's kind of in line to the throne. His offspring will not be, unless, I guess, many people die or something like that, but he won't. So this is kind of something that they can spare as the family. I'm saying, is it possible that this is a political move, that this is like an instruction, Harry, do this?
I'm not sure. I think the guy's a little bit mixed up. He's allegedly not Prince Charles's son. I mean, it was heavily rumored that Princess Diana, his mother, was having an affair with Major James Hewitt. Now, if you look at pictures of Major James Hewitt and look at pictures of Prince Harry, well, I mean, it doesn't really take much of a mental jump to connect those dots, because they look almost identical. What's more, he looks nothing like his father. He looks nothing like his brother. And I think growing up, probably learning that he isn't his father's son, that he isn't who he has been told he is, playing that role and going somewhat off the rails from time to time, I do believe that he's probably been mixed up, and that's why he's ended up with this older woman. That's why he's ended up taking solace in this way. And he probably thinks that all of this will make him very popular, will make him very hip with the youngsters, and that he will be embraced. Maybe he's one of those people who, I don't know what goes on behind closed doors, but if you knew that your partner was cheating on you, if you knew your partner was giving birth to another man's child, would you love that child in the same way that you loved your own? Most likely not.
Probably not, no.
And he's probably looking for some kind of validation, and he's looking for validation by making the multicultural establishment love him and hold him up as some kind of hero, which is the worst kind of validation possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Groveling, kind of kowtowing to the establishment and what they want. Who knows? That would be sad if that's the case. You know, I showed some images earlier of all the different girlfriends and women that he'd been involved in over, what, 10-year period, and there were, like, certainly, and some of them, I believe, were actually even, like, they were, what, aristocrats, what's the term? They're not royals,
yeah,
but they were aristocratic.
They were right? Standing, who you would imagine would fit into royal society well.
Yeah.
They're not people who have made sex tapes or who have been, you know, who handed out bags of drugs at previous weddings. They're not those kind of people. They're people of good standing. But he's given up on that. Oh, my gosh, those pictures you've got up on screen. I mean, anyone who thinks those two aren't related needs to go to Specsavers.
Yeah, and that's, again, why it's interesting, right, that the fact that if internally there is knowledge that Diana did have an affair with Hewitt, then it would be like, well, then he's kind of, we can spare that guy, right? He makes us look good, we can spare it, let him do this. Because supposedly there's this other issue too, the fact that he was introduced some a friend to her, what's her name again? Meghan Markle, right? He was introduced to her by another friend who some people said had an interest of a particular tribe that had an interest in maybe making sure that the British family goes in this direction, shall we say.
Yes, she was what's known as a tribal matchmaker, in fact. And I remember this at the time because I tweeted it out and I was like, another coincidence.
Yeah, I forget her name now, but yeah, she introduced them, I believe. But all right, enough of that with the royal family. There's not much value to these, obviously, these families. But again, I think why it's important to follow this and look at it is because it's interesting to see how the perception also changes of the royal family kind of internationally in the media and stuff like that when things like this happen. You know, previously they're stale and they're almost like upkeepers of racism and colonialism. And now all of a sudden it's great, it's wonderful, right? All these Americans are drawn into it now, and now it's, so it's kind of fun to watch as it's a propaganda effort, I think, that they visually can, like, destroy something that was exclusively British and in upkeep tradition for the longest time. So I think that they see this as a victory. That's why it's interesting watching it, you know?
Oh, I definitely agree with you. The multiculturalists do see this as a victory. They have literally shoved it down people's throats. But interestingly, I did a video on this at the time about the royal wedding, is the wedding between Meghan and Harry was very, very unpopular. And when you actually compared the number of street parties held, the TV viewership, it actually turned the vast majority of people off. Because the people that Meghan and Harry are trying to reach out to are not royalists. They aren't people who are interested in the royal family. People who are staunch royalists, the people who have actually defended the royal family and have fought for the royal family to remain in the position they are, have been turned off en masse by this embarrassing spectacle. And that's the interesting thing, because the Meghan and Harry debacle really has actually weakened the royals' position, because it's turned their core supporters against them. And I don't believe it will actually recruit any hardcore leftists or hardcore Republicans to their cause. And it's another one of those giant marketing gaffes that will just leave the royals more alienated than they were before.
Yeah, definitely. Yep, good take on that. All right, so let's switch over and talk a little bit about UKIP, the controversy surrounding there. There's a number of things that which have happened here in the last couple of days, really, when it comes to Sargon of Akkad, Carl Benjamin, even Tommy Robinson. They've gone on to join UKIP, and then, of course, weaved into this, we've had...
Tommy hasn't joined UKIP. He was an independent advisor. He's standing as an independent in the northwest of England. So.
Oh, okay, then I got that wrong. Interesting. I thought he was involved or something like that. But, okay, regardless, Nigel Farage, of course, he jumped ship a while ago, and he started up the Brexit Party, so there's a lot to kind of unpack here. But let's talk about Sargon first. Now, I should say I'm not a fan of Sargon in many regards, but having seen how he has been treated in the British press the last week, really, in terms of these comments that he made and stuff, and basically his entire streaming past and all his videos. They're starting to comb through everything, looking for, you know, compromising comments and things like this. And the interviews he's done by these dumb idiot reporters are just have been astonishing to watch. And he's continuously said, you know, Carl Sagan, that like these are jokes. I'm saying it because I don't like political correctness. It's almost like done intentionally. But it looks to me from the outside, he's not part of the political establishment. And here comes an outsider, and they are doing everything they can to break this guy down in every capacity. I just have one search page up right now from Google News in terms of how much play he is in the news right now. We've seen Carl Benjamin's rank misogyny before. Remember Gamergate? UKIP Canada investigated over rape comments. Under siege for his comments about rape, UKIP star candidate Carl Benjamin has recruited Milo Yiannopoulos to join his campaign. What do you make of this, Mark, and how should we break this down?
Well, there's so much to digest here, but I want to start being quite favourable, actually, to Carl. I want to say that Sargon taking the message from the internet to the real world is very, very admirable. We must get involved in real world politics because we aren't changing the world from our front rooms, from YouTube, from social networks. The only way to win is to build real world communities and challenge the political status quo and seize power for ourselves. And for his bravery and for his willingness to engage in the political system and to try to take politics or his brand of politics to the real world, I absolutely praise him. I take my hat off to him. I would shake him by the hand and I would say, well done, Carl. You have done something very brave and something that we all must do.
I agree. Yeah. No, that's why. And I saw all the attacks on him. I obviously became, it's funny because it's like, you know, you're in this little circle, right? And how does he define himself politically? Center, a little bit to the right, maybe, or something like that. But yeah, he's anti-political correctness and feminism, basically, right? So, but when you see a guy who's been kind of roped up with people like us, nationalists and stuff like that, you do develop kind of a bond of sorts and a relationship with the guy, although I've never spoken to him. So to see him attacked by these stupid reporters and these just baseless, frankly, ridiculous accusations in the media, I become defensive and like, God, like, okay, the guy is kind of an idiot on some things, but he surely doesn't deserve this, what's happened to him here. And the way that, would they scrutinize any other politician like this? No, never.
Well, I did say however. There is a big however here. The problem with Sargon is, despite his bravery and despite his willingness to take on the establishment, he has done so in the most ham-fisted and poorly thought out way possible. And unfortunately, due to some of the things he's done, where he has tried to be edgy, he's tried to be funny, and what he's chosen to double down on, the hill he's chosen to die on, is all wrong. And unfortunately, he is now crashing the UKIP campaign. And when this is all said and done, I will do a full sort of hour and a half, 2 hour breakdown of it on my own channel, and go through everything that's been said and done in detail. But what I will say now is the public want a candidate that is politically incorrect. But what do the public think when they say political correctness? Well, when the public say politically incorrect, they think about someone who will happily say Muslims are behind terrorist attacks. They think of somebody who will say that Muslim grooming gangs are affecting our country. They are looking for someone who will say things that are blatant truths that normal people feel that they can't say but want to say. Now, unfortunately, Sargon hasn't talked about politically incorrect things. He hasn't talked about grooming gangs. He hasn't talked about Islamic terrorism. He isn't talking about race and demographics. He isn't talking about things that people would class as politically incorrect, but important topics. Instead, the hill he has chosen to die on is one of sending what are generally seen as pretty stupid tweets. And recently he's doubled down on them. You know, he tweeted out that he wouldn't even rape Jess Phillips. And then recently he's doubled down on that on a video on his YouTube channel and said, you know, he may well cave in. You know, he may well cave into pressure. But then he makes the joke, you know, but there's not enough beer in the world. Now, I don't know why he's doing this, because making politically incorrect points. And let's compare him with Tommy Robinson. Tommy Robinson is going out there and he's making politically incorrect points. He's talking about grooming gangs. He's talking about the Islamization of the West. And he is campaigning on those topics. And they are things that people genuinely care about. People in the pub, in the working men's clubs, they want to be able to talk about issues of race, Islam, ethnicity, culture, multiculturalism. No one in the working men's club or the pub is talking about the need or the right to send rape tweets. People don't want that. That's not something that people actually want. That's a bad hill to die on. It's not a vote winner. And by repeatedly goading the media into misquoting him and feeding the media these quotes, knowing that they will misquote him, he's dying on a hill that ultimately isn't popular. This isn't something that people want to vote for. And my concern is that he is completely failing to articulate any points that resonate with the people, and instead fighting a campaign that pleads his brand of YouTube followers who are spread all over the world. He has great, you know, great number of followers, but they're spread all over the world. And unfortunately, by doing this, he is destroying UKIP, who stood a record number of candidates in the recent council elections. In fact, they stood over 1,400 candidates in the recent council elections, and they managed to actually make a net loss on the 4-year cycle. From the, when you compare their 2015 results, which was the same point in the cycle, to where we are this year, 2019, they were actually down 145 councillors on 2015. And you have to ask yourself, what is the effect he has had on that? Now, people might say, well, what about Brexit Party? Brexit Party didn't stand in those council elections. So here we have a perfect storm. We have mass immigration. We have the failure of the politicians to deliver on Brexit. And Sargon comes into UKIP and sees them take these record losses. They actually lost more seats than the Labour Party did. Labour Party made a net loss of 82 seats. UKIP made a net loss of 145 seats. And I find that very disturbing. Now, my message to Sargon would be, stop baiting the media with comments that people generally find distasteful, with these distasteful jokes, and instead start talking about things people want to actually vote for, which is candidates who discuss grooming gangs, Islam, demographics, immigration. That's what affects working class communities in Britain. Working class communities are not affected by the lack of rights to send tweets about rape. That is not something that the broad masses are concerned about. In fact, it's something that the broad masses who do agree with us find awfully distasteful.
Yeah, some people have speculated that he's doing this because it does benefit himself, his own brand, effectively, right, just choosing to go into politics. I don't know if he has a history of always loving the UKIP of what they were doing. I thought, at least in the early days, and I know people change and all that stuff, right, but that they have, I don't know, he didn't like UKIP initially, I thought, but I might be mistaken on that. But this was some kind of attempt to, you know, again, as an insider, come in there and actually help to ruin things, to break it down. I have no basis, no backing for that, or no proof for that, really. But it is interesting that he has chosen to continue to do things which he knows the media, as we know, and you know this very well too, Mark, they are unable to understand anything which is humorous. They will take everything literally, and they will use it against you at any turn that they can, right? So as he continues to make these jokes, it's just he's burying himself deeper. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, let's look at this from a really, really honest perspective. Now, when I was in the British National Party, we won two seats in the European Parliament. And that was massive at the time. Now, UKIP barred ex-BNP members from joining their party, citing people like Nick Griffin as like the big bad guys. Well, honestly, Nick Griffin and everything Nick Griffin said throughout his political career is less toxic than what Sargon has said. Nick Griffin never used the fabled N-word. Nick Griffin never sent tweets which could be characterized as rape tweets. Nick Griffin never, ever sat down and had cozy fireside chats with people advocating for paedophilia. Now, I am not saying in any way that Sargon advocates for paedophilia. I do not think he's a paedophile. I believe he's a married man. I think he has kids. I might be wrong about that. I do not think he's a paedophile. But I find it awfully, awfully stupid, short-sighted, and rather abhorrent that he sat down with two separate people, someone named Justicar and someone named Amos Yee, and had very, very cordial chats with them when both of them were advocating for paedophilia. Now, firstly, it's absolutely, I wouldn't want to be in the same room as those people. I wouldn't want to hold conversations with them unless, however, I was in a courtroom sentencing them to life in jail. You know, these people are absolute deviants who want to push an unthinkable sickness upon society. Yet Sargon felt it was acceptable to sit and chat with them and try to find some kind of common ground. Now, I'm not saying he accepted their points, because I don't believe he did. He clearly said he doesn't accept their points. But by holding those forms of chats, it shows a profound naivety, a profound stupidity, and a complete lack of understanding to what normal people in the real world think about those who advocate for such sickening things as paedophilia and sex with underage, with children, with minors. And all these things are now coming back to bite him. Yes, he is being quoted out of context, but I have listened to those chats and there were some very creepy and very toe-curling moments of those chats where he almost seemed to be trying to find, you know, some form of justification for what those people were trying to say. And all of this is coming back to bite him. And as I said, it's so ironic that UKIP barred ex-BNP members from joining the party, but now have openly courted and embraced a man who has essentially said far, far worse and done far worse than people like Nick Griffin or myself ever did.
Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? Well, it's not strange, I guess, but yeah, it's true. I don't know what to make of Sargon of Akkad and what he's doing to the party. Is there any silver lining in this? I mean, if he managed to disrupt really destroy UKIP and the credibility of UKIP, are those voters now going to the Brexit party, do you think? What's happening with that? As far as I understand the situation, Brexit party is only running in the European elections. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, what you may well see here, and this is something to consider, at the European elections in 2014, UKIP won. They actually won. A party, an outsider party without any members of parliament, won the European election. Now, that is phenomenal. That is something that's unheard of in British politics for an outsider party, post-Second World War, for an outsider party to come out of nowhere and win a national election, pushing Labour into second and the Conservatives into third, and to take, I believe it was 24 seats in the European Parliament and to win overall. That's a massive achievement. And you could well see now UKIP at the next European election getting no seats whatsoever, which Wow. would be the biggest capitulation a party has ever made post-Second World War in the UK. And Sargon will be part of that. Now, I know that Brexit Party has come up. I know Nigel Farage left, and I know they're getting built up by the media. But you only need about 6% to get a couple of seats. The BNP got about 6%. They won two seats. And to fall under that and to get nothing when previously winning it, that would be a major, major horror story. And if Sargon does wreck UKIP, it will actually be quite unfortunate in some ways, because there is no real nationalist alternative in the UK. UKIP is the alternative, and it does have a structure. It had the power to stand 1,400 council election candidates, and to see only 31 of those get elected at a time when it couldn't be better for a party like that, I think that's very, very telling. And I think people at UKIP HQ now need to be looking at themselves. And as I've said earlier today, it is very unfortunate, but Sargon is failing to communicate any form of policy to the public. He just isn't communicating policy at all. He instead is talking about why he won't apologize for sending these tweets. And he isn't even doing it in a good way. For example, and what I mean by a good way, and this, I'll be very clear about this. Why isn't he saying things like, why are you attacking me over a tweet when you covered up Muslims grooming and raping tens of thousands of British girls? Are you saying that actual rape is not as bad as sending a tweet about rape?
Right.
But he's not saying that. He is refusing to actually grasp the nettle because he doesn't believe in identity politics. He doesn't believe in grouping people together. So because he doesn't believe in grouping people together, he won't talk about that issue. And you see, Tommy Robinson, he gets condemnation, but people support him. The public support him. And the public support him because he is condemned, but he is making a genuine political point that ultimately people do care about, that people are affected about. Just the other day, I posted on my Twitter one of the most shocking and harrowing clips you could imagine. It's of a young girl in Liverpool walking home. It looks like she's walking home from school, filming herself as she is being stalked and followed by a car full of what appears to be Muslim groomers. And she's shouting, "Leave me alone, stop following me." Yet Sargon is not talking about that. He's talking about his right to send distasteful tweets to members of parliament. Well, I'm sorry, I do believe in free speech, but if I'm going to start talking about important policies, there's a lot of things that are going to resonate with the public a lot more than what he's doing. And I think he is showing a great naivety. And if he does carry on down this line, if he does carry on having these silly confrontations, and by bringing it back up, he has now got himself investigated by the police by actually making a joke that could be characterized as a threat when he knew the police were already looking into him. He's just giving the tabloid press all the ammunition they need, because now they can say that the police are investigating him for a second set of rape jokes or rape tweets or rape comments, this time on YouTube. Why give the press that ammunition? I don't know.
Right, and that's how they do it, right? And they just keep on hammering. They find the next thing and the next thing, and they just keep pushing. And well, now he's not apologizing. Now he's making, you know, he's being investigated by the police now. And it's like, wait. Like, obviously, this is not what happened. You know, for those who know the truth, it's like he did literally just make jokes about this. And again, he's continued on this line to prove the point that it's like, see, you can't even make jokes about this stuff. They're attacking you. They think it's serious. But they're running with it, right? And Jess Phillips has come out and say, I felt violated or something like that, right? So they just keep knocking down his line. And as you said, now he's being investigated. Some people say he might even end up in jail because of this, because they might find him guilty on this, right?
They may charge him. They may charge him. And if they do that, you know, I don't believe that he deserves charging, but I believe that he is goading the media, and the things he's goading the media over are the wrong things. I don't care at the moment whether, you know, the public don't care whether people have the right to send these, you know, what are, frankly, you know, quite cringy tweets. What I care about is demographic change. I care about the Islamization of our country. I care about the right to speak about genuine, politically incorrect things that actually affect us. And he has taken this free speech fight to such a bizarre abstraction that I fear it isn't going to resonate with normal people. And that is who we're trying to reach out to, normal people. And he's playing his hand in a very, very foolish manner.
And selfish, selfish manner too, I feel.
Exactly. To center the free speech debate upon something like this is counterproductive, especially when we have so many wonderful things to argue free speech over. Why can't we speak out about young white girls being sexually abused by Muslim males? Why can't we talk about that? Because it's happening and it's a real problem. That is a good thing to center the free speech debate about. Centering this free speech debate on this is absolutely foolish. And also, what people are really missing here is, in our society, there is nothing more frowned upon, nothing more taboo, and nothing more stomach-churning to normal people than things such as rape, things such as paedophilia. And by allowing yourself to be mischaracterized over that and playing up to a mischaracterization on those grounds, which he is doing, he's playing up to this, you are literally painting the worst picture of you possible and allowing the media to paint the worst picture of you possible. And the thing is, people are looking for people who are strong enough to stand up, talk about things such as Islamization. They are looking for people strong enough to stand up and say, I'm sick of mass migration. I want to keep Britain ethnically British. I want to keep Britain culturally British. They are not looking for a politician who wants to make lewd Roy Chubby Brown-esque comments on Twitter. No one is crying out for that.
Yeah, I was trying to find the link here. I know that they spun that thing with pedophilia too, right? He's justifying it, and you could see the transformation of the headlines. And again, the reason, in other regards, the UK press is fine with this. They almost even allow it and push it. So is the American press in some regards. But now it's because it's a UKIP candidate. So now they can pick it up and now they use it against someone like Carl or Sargon. And so, again, it's disgusting to see this in real time, how they're lying. And again, as soon as you kind of have an in a little bit, you know about the person that the media is writing about, you can see how dishonest they are. You can see how much they lie and stuff. But this is their MO, and to a certain extent, he should have known that. But he seems to be more interested in kind of just egging this on and pushing these buttons of the press to prove his own point. But as you said, in the attempt to do that, he's helping to destroy UKIP. I've seen Gerard Batten speaking out. He's defended him on a couple of occasions. I saw in a, I think with Piers Morgan, Nigel Farage did an interview with him, and he basically agreed when Piers Morgan called Sargon disgusting, right? And it's like, this is not good, you know, not good for the nationalist parties in the UK.
Let me ask you a question. You and Lana, I believe Red Ice Radio, and I've said this multiple times, is the premier nationalist media startup. You guys are the premier when it comes to nationalist media. Your stuff is very, very professional. It's wonderful, and you give a platform to so many people, both very, very well-known people and also people who are just starting out. You're great at finding new talent. Now,
thank you.
Would you ever have guests on like Amos Yee who are pushing for the normalization, acceptance, and legalization of paedophilia?
No, what the hell is, why? There's so many other issues. And again, you're getting that from the mainstream. You're not the whole mainstream, but you're literally from the fringes of the left wing, the cultural Marxist kind of fringe. You're getting already a justification for that. Why would Sargon be even interested in giving a voice to that, right? He should see this. He should see through that, you'd think.
That is, I'm going to put a real point on it here. Paedophilia and the acceptance of underage sex is the final place this slide towards sexual degeneracy will go. And we're already seeing it. We're seeing it with Drag Queen Story Hour. We're seeing it with these child drag queens who are dancing on stage at gay bars, having money thrown at them at LGBT plus pride events. And all of this is actually part of the cultural Marxists' plan to make us live in a complete debased and moralless society. So why on earth would somebody actually entertain that and speak to these people? And I don't know, but he did. And he did so twice.
I should say,
I want to stress again, I know they have mischaracterized his comments, but the fact he allowed himself, or the fact he consented to those kind of very cozy chats with those kind of sick-minded and deplorable individuals, really does show that he has a complete lack of judgment. And by doing this, he's not only destroyed UKIP externally, but they have had a record number of leading officials and party activists leave the party over this.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, comments like this, people pulled out, right? It depends on the child, whether they're able to consent to sex, you know, even if they're well under the age of 11. And he talked with the reporter and said, well, it was a thought experiment. It was to make a point. And it's like, okay, great. But then he's like, what, as a principled centrist, he keeps on like hammering that point or trying to defend it even further when it's like, let's move on from there. And as you said, like, hold the media accountable for the way that they covered up actual rape, for example, right? So turn it on them, do so. You'd think he'd know this. And okay, granted, not everyone know how they would react in front of the, I mean, he's been in front of the cameras, but it's been his own camera, right? Getting the mainstream press on you and the cameras and the lights and these reporters and stuff. And sure, there might be things which doesn't click as fast as if you were in your own controlled environment kind of thing. But he's not, in that sense, he's not stupid. He should have been able to turn that on its head, and he failed to do so, which is really disappointing, frankly.
It's, again, he isn't someone either who is good at debating people. Every time he goes into a debate, he's debated with me, he's debated much more famously with Richard Spencer, he debated with Andrew Anglin, and every time he debates with people, he comes out looking as if he's just been schooled. And he isn't someone who fires back witty and intelligent answers. And because of this, I'll give you an example. He thinks that parroting the term dirty, dirty smear merchant every time the media rings him up is some kind of absolute silver bullet. And every time he says it, his fans cheer. And he's now selling T-shirts with dirty, dirty smear merchants written on. Wonderful. But that quote means nothing. That quote means nothing. When a newspaper rings you up and asks for a comment, they have to print your reply, and they do print a reply. And if you give them a nothing, you see, to the public, saying that they're dirty, dirty smear merchants isn't a reason to vote for you. Now, when they speak to somebody like Tommy Robinson, Tommy Robinson says, well, I'm standing here because I'm the only one who dares to speak about the grooming of white schoolgirls in this area by men of Pakistani Muslim descent. Wow. Well, that's a reason to vote for him. That's a reply. But dirty, dirty smear merchants is just a smug, self-serving meme to please his YouTube subscribers. It isn't something that will make people vote for him. And he believes that by doing all of this, by refusing to apologize, by not backing down, by doubling down on these rape comments, he's the British Donald Trump. But he's not. Donald Trump doubled down on things like immigration control. He doubled down on Islamic terrorism. He doubled down on border control, on building a wall, on facts, on immigration and how immigration has affected the US. He doubled down on the facts about Mexican drug runners. Sargon is doubling down over tweets about raping an MP. Now, I'm sorry, but he comparing himself to Donald Trump, and due to his unwillingness to apologize, is absolutely foolish, because what he's not apologizing over isn't something that the public are actually interested in.
Yeah, it's true. It's really, really sad. I wanted to bring in Tommy into the conversation here a little bit too and talk about him and what happened to him. But you know what we'll do? We'll take a short break, Mark, and then we'll continue to do that in part two as we continue here. Mark, tell us about your stuff, where people can find your material. You still have the book, right? The Fall of Western Man. People can both buy and get a free e-version of that too, e-copy.
Grab a free copy. It's there for free as a PDF. Download it, and if you like it, send it out to all your friends and family. That's why it's free, so it can go as far and wide as humanly possible. You can also buy a copy if you want to support me, and it would be great if you hopped on over to my YouTube channel, watch some of my content, you know, subscribed, and if you really like it, you know, again, share it with your friends and family.
Yes, absolutely. Again, we'll link up, guys, the YouTube channel, so you guys can head on over there and make sure you subscribe and check out the new show, but the rebranding, I guess, of the show, Patriotic Weekly Review. Did the first show with Adam Green, good friend of our show here as well. He does some great stuff, so definitely make sure you check that out. And of course, follow Mark on Twitter as well. We'll have these linked up in the description, guys. Check it out. Thank you, Mark, for the first part. Stay with us, everybody. We'll be right back in part two.
They are rejoicing. Join the new resistance, Red Ice.